Majors and Quinn presents J. Ryan Stradell.
Now, please join me in welcoming J. Ryan.
Thanks, everyone. It's a real, it's really, really surreal that just have this happen, period. As a lot of you know, I've been writing for a long time, and I've always wanted to write a book. My mom was a huge influence on me, helping me to learn how to read when I was young, and I just grew up in a house where I felt like, oh, the coolest thing to do would be to write a book. And from when I was a little kid, she caught me writing written by Ryan Stradell inside of Richard Scarry's Cars and Trucks and Things That Go. So it's actually really nice to have a book that actually has my name printed on it already, and I don't have to just cross someone else's. Oh, hey, Anya. Good to see you. I'll read a couple little pieces from the book and take questions at the end, or insults or projectiles. And thank you so much for coming. I look forward to talking to you afterwards as well. I think we're going to convene at Republic across the street. I'd heard from the staff here that it's got an open plan kind of thing. So, looking for a room that we can hang out in. I can talk to more people later. So, all right. I guess I'll start at the beginning. Torvald loved two women. That was it, he thought in passing, while he sat on the cold concrete steps of his apartment building. Perhaps he would have loved more than two, but it just didn't seem like things were going to work out like that. That morning, while defying a doctor's orders by pureeing a braised pork shoulder, he'd stared out his kitchen window at the snow on the roof of the Happy Chef restaurant across the highway and sang a love song to one of those two girls, his baby daughter, while she slept on the living room floor. He was singing a Beatles song, replacing the name of the girl in the old tune with the name of the girl in the room. He hadn't told a woman, I love you, until he was 28. He didn't lose his virginity until he was 28 either. At least he'd had his first kiss when he was 21, even if that woman quit returning his calls a week later. Lars blamed his sorry luck with women on his lack of teenage romance, and he blamed his lack of teenage romance on the fact that he was the worst-smelling kid in his grade every year. He stunk like the floor of a fish market every Christmas, starting at age 12. And even when he didn't smell terrible, the other kids acted like he did, because that's what kids do. Fish boy, they called him, year-round, and it was all the fault of an old Swedish woman named Dorothy Seaborg. On a December afternoon in 1971, Dorothy Seaborg of Duluth, Minnesota, fell on the ice and broke her hip while walking to her mailbox, disrupting the supply line of lutefisk for the Sunday Advent dinners at St. Olaf's Lutheran Church. Lars's father, Gustav Torvald, of Duluth's Gustav and Sons Bakery, and one of the most conspicuous Norwegians between Cloquet and Two Harbors, promised everyone in St. Olaf's Fellowship Hall that there would be no break in lutefisk continuity. His family would step in and carry on this brutal Scandinavian tradition for the benefit of everyone in the Twin Ports region. Never mind that neither Gustav, his wife, nor his children had ever seen a live whitefish before, much less caught one, pounded it, dried it, soaked it in lye, re-soaked it in cold water, and done the careful cooking required to make something that, when perfectly prepared, looks like jellied smog and smells like boiled aquarium water. Since everyone in the house was equally unqualified for the job, the work fell to Lars, age 12, and his younger brother Jarl, age 10, sparing the youngest sibling, 9-year-old Sigmund, but only because he actually liked the stuff. If Lars and Jarl don't like it, Gustav told his wife Elaine, I can count on them not to eat any. It'll eliminate loss and breakage. Well, Gustav was satisfied with this reasoning, and Elaine still thought it was a mean thing to do to their young sons. She said nothing. Theirs was a mixed-race marriage between a Norwegian and a Dane, and thus all things culturally important to one but not the other were given a free pass and critiqued only in unmixed company. Yearly intimate contact with their cultural heritage failed to evolve the Torvald boy's sensibilities. Jarl, who still ate his own snot, much preferred the taste of boogers to lutefisk, being that the color and the consistency were the same. Lars, meanwhile, was still stumped by the old Scandinavian women who walked up to him in church and said, "Any young man who makes lutefisk like you is going to be quite a hit with the ladies." And Lars's experience, lutefisk skills, usually inspired revulsion, or at best indifference, among prospective dates. Even the girls who claimed they liked lutefisk didn't want to smell it when they weren't eating it, and Lars couldn't give them much of a choice. The once anticipated holiday season had become for Lars a cruel month of stench and rejection, and thanks to the boys at school, its social effects lingered long after everyone's desiccated Christmas trees were abandoned by the curbside. By the time Lars was 18, whatever tolerance he'd once had for this uncompromising tradition had long eroded. His hands were scarred from several advents of soaking dried whitefish in lye, and every year the smell clung harder to his pores, fingernails, hair, and shoes, and not just because their surface area had increased with maturity. Lars had also grown to become a little wizard in the kitchen, and by unintentionally mastering the tragic hobby of lutefisk preparation, its potency was skyrocketing. Lutherans were driving from as far away as Fergus Falls to have the Torvald lutefisk. And there wasn't an attractive young woman among any of them. As if to mock him further each year, Lars's dad would shove a forkful of the crap in his face each Christmas. "Just a bite," Gustav would say. "Your ancestors ate this to survive the long winters." "And how did they survive lutefisk?" Lars asked once. "Take some pride in your work, son," Gustav said, and took away his left son punishment. Yeah, I know. In 1978, Lars graduated from high school and got the heck out of Duluth. His grades could have gotten him into a nice Lutheran school, like Gustavus Adolphus or Augsburg. But Lars wanted to be a chef, and he didn't see what good college would do him other than delay that goal by 4 years. Instead, he moved down to the cities, looking for a girlfriend and for kitchen work, in either order, requiring only that no one insist he makes lutefisk. And that attitude left a lot more options open than his dad predicted. After a 10-year unpaid apprenticeship at Gustav & Sons, Lars was already skilled at baking, arguably the most difficult of all the culinary duties, but didn't want to fall back on that, because he only chose jobs that could teach him something, and only went on dates about as often as a vegetarian restaurant opens near an interstate highway. He gained a pretty decent handle on French, Italian, German, and American cuisine in just under a decade. By October 1987, as his home state was enraptured by the Twins winning their first World Series ever, Lars had earned a job as a chef at Huttmacher's, a trendy lakeside restaurant that attracted big celebrities like meteorologists, state senators, and local pro athletes. For years, it was said, a Twins player could enjoy his meals at Huttmacher's unremarked and unmolested. But by the week Lars was hired, jubilant ballplayers were regularly turning the late shift into an upbeat party. Amid the circumstance of a long-suffering sports team's success, the strange joy of it all spread through the restaurant. It was during these happy weeks when Cynthia Hargreaves, the smartest waitress on staff, she gave the best wine pairing advice of any of the servers, seemed to take an interest in Lars. By this time he was 28, growing a pale, hairy inner tube around his waist, and already going bald. Even though she had an overbite in the shakes, she was 6 feet tall and beautiful. And not like a statue or a perfume advertisement, but in a realistic way, like how a truck or a pizza is beautiful in the moment you want it most. And this, to Lars, made her feel approachable. When she came back to the kitchen, the guys would check her out, but Lars refrained. Said he'd look her in the face when he told her things like, "Tell him it'll be 5 more minutes on that veal." And, "No, I will not hold the garlic. It's pesto." "Oh, can't you make a sauce with just pine nuts, olive oil, basil, and Romano?" she asked. He was a bit impressed that she knew the other ingredients off the top of her head. Maybe he shouldn't have been, but it just wasn't the kind of thing he expected people outside a kitchen to know. He knew he must have communicated this to her when he saw how she was smiling back at him, knowingly, like he'd been caught in the act of something. "Well, you know I can try," he said, "but then it's not pesto, it's something else." "How fresh is the basil?" she asked. "Pesto lives or dies by its basil." He admired her decisive way of phrasing an incorrect opinion. It was actually the preparation that determined the quality. Proper pesto, he had learned during a previous job at Pronto Ristorante, is made with a mortar and pestle. It makes all the difference. "It's 2 days old," he said. "Where'd you get it? The St. Paul Farmer's Market?" "Yeah, from Anna Hlavik." "Oh, you should get it from Ellen Chamberlain." Ellen grows the best basil. Such wonderfully erroneous food opinions. This is getting Lars all riled up. Still in his Minneapolis years, liberated from both his ludicrous stench and its reputation, he'd driven women away due to what they called his eagerness, and he couldn't allow that to happen again. "Oh, does she now?" he asked her, continuing to work, not looking up at her. "Yeah," she said, stepping closer to him, trying to keep him engaged. Anna grows sweet corn in the same plot as her basil. You know what sweet corn does to soil. She had a point if that were true. I didn't know Anna grew sweet corn. "Oh, she doesn't sell it to the public." She smiled at him again. "And I'll tell my customer yes on the garlic-free pesto." "Why?" "I want to see you work a little harder back here," she said. He couldn't help it. He was in love by the time she left the kitchen. But love made him feel sad and doomed, as usual. What he didn't know was that she'd suffered through a decade of cool, commitment-phobic men, and Lars's kindness, but mostly his effusive, overt enthusiasm for her, was at that time exactly what she was looking for in a partner. Thank you. Hey, Kate. Oh, good to see you, John. Yeah. Yeah, this is wonderful. All right. Before I read the next segment, any questions? This is the crowd I'm most worried about on the entire tour. yes, Sue Fleet.
Why are you wearing that hat?
Oh, it's Hastings Raiders. Class of 94 rules. Yeah. Oh, sorry, Brandon. You know, class of 98 is pretty good, you know? Yeah, pretty good, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, anyone else?
What did people in California think of the bizarre foreign food in the book?
You know, it's I've read that chapter there, and I usually end up having to explain it to them afterwards. Like, yeah. And there's another chapter I read in April when I was here in Minneapolis that delineates between the ELCA and Missouri Synod Lutherans. Like, it sinks like a stone there in that crowd. So, yeah, no, it is obscure ethnic cuisine to them, yeah. I mean, they don't even really grow rhubarb in California. Yeah, it's not a good, you know, they can grow everything else, but not those winter crops. Hey, Casey. Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, Sue again, yes.
Somebody asked about the pronunciation of hummus in the book.
I'd say hummus. Yeah, it just goes with everything. All right, I'll read a little piece from the Walleye chapter, which it's told from the point of view of a character named Will Prager, who my main character Eva meets in high school. It was not just Will Prager's opinion, but also unbiased fact, that in order to get girls in high school, you had to have a thing. Maybe your thing was that your mom or dad was a lawyer and you lived in a nice house with a pool. Maybe it was rock-hard abs. Maybe your thing was that you're a computer nerd and you spent prom night in your parents' basement listening to Rush and thinking about string theory. There was someone for everyone, just so long as you were someone. Until freshman year, Will Prager didn't have a thing. He was smart, but not a super genius, and played sports, but not well enough to ever get a scholarship somewhere. Then some seniors who were in a band called Smarmy Kitten invited him personally. Then some seniors who were in a band called Smarmy Kitten invited him personally to see one of their shows. Their lead guitarist, Brandon Spencer, who always wore t-shirts of really obscure stuff like Merzbo and Zodiac Records, and was the coolest guy in the band, looked Prager in the eye and said, "Hey man, you should come to our gig, you'd like it." Well, he did. And ever since, Will Prager's thing was music. In the summer of 2005 alone, he drove the 45 minutes from River Falls, Wisconsin to Minneapolis 10 times and saw Built to Spill, Drive By Truckers, Spoon, High Respects, Dillinger 4, Boiled in Lead, Maytiera, Tapes and Tapes, The Owls, and Atmosphere with Brother Ali, mostly with his friends Vic Gupta and Ken Kovacs. He also started a band called The Lonesome Cowboys with Vic on drums, Ken on bass, Zach Schmetterling on pedal steel, Eric Travis on violin, and Will on lead guitar and vocals. Their thing was that they played sad cowboy music and played cover songs in the style of sad cowboy music. Their cover of No Diggity was off the chain. It made hot girls forget you were a dork, which is the point of all music. Girls were lucky. They didn't have to have a thing. They just had to look nice and come to your shows and not call you all the time about stupid stuff. But the new girl in the back of Killer Keeley's fifth period American history class, first day of school, junior year, she for sure had a thing. She had an oxblood Doc Martens, black nail polish, a black miniskirt, bright red manic panic hair, and a white t-shirt that read, "The Smiths" and "Meat is Murder." Total goth. What was North America like before the Europeans arrived? Killer Keeley asked. Will Prager raised his hand, and Killer Keeley continued looking around the classroom. It was time for Prager to set the tone for how the junior year was going to go. Anyone else? Mr. Keeley asked. He somehow already knew better than to call on Prager, but no one else had his hand up. It was fifth period, right after lunch, so everyone was in a food coma, and it was 85 degrees outside, and the question was insultingly broad. I just want to be in love, Prager said. Will you help me or not? I didn't call on you, William, said Mr. Keeley. Prager sang the first lines of Where is the Love? By Roberta Flack. And the cute new girl in back, the goth, laughed. Rumor was Killer Keeley had gone soft over the last couple of years. Now, thanks to Prager, he was losing this new batch of juniors in record time. At the end of class, Prager got a good look at the girl who had laughed at his heartbreaking rendition of the Roberta Flack, Donnie Hathaway soul classic. She was even hotter than at first glance. She had boobs and an ass that looked too amazing for mere Wisconsin boys in their cold, jittery hands, and he imagined her in Miami, riding a dolphin while wearing a bikini, capsizing sailboats full of horny men. Plus, she was tall, at least 6'2", which was cool with Prager because he was 6'4", and she thought he was funny, which was also pretty sexy. An hour later, walking into Madame Duplessis' seventh period French class, he saw her seated in the back and probably smiled when he saw her, but tried not to in case she saw him. The seat next to her was left open, and even though he didn't like sitting in the back row because his vision wasn't so good, he took it. Hey, he said, glancing in her direction. Hey, she said brightly, even welcomingly, he thought. What's your name? He asked. Eva, she said. You? Uh-oh. He had to think for a second how to phrase it in a way that sounded memorable. Will Prager, he said. Now he had to keep the conversation flowing somehow. So, you like the Smiths? He asked, trying to look at her shirt without simultaneously staring at her chest. Yeah, they're okay, she said. You a vegetarian? He asked. No, I just wanted a Smith shirt. You? Oh, yeah, I just started, he said. He'd seen a documentary about chickens at Ken Kovac's house the week before that had converted both of them, that converted both him and Ken. It was now another thing they had, in addition to the band. Madame Duplessis stood in front of the class, dressed for the heat in a sleeveless sundress, straight brown hair glistening under the fluorescent lights. She was kind of cute, but was also the mom of a kid who was a freshman, so that was weird. Regardez ici, s'il vous plaît, Madame Duplessis said. A bientôt, Will Prager said to Eva. Damn, that was smooth, he thought as he turned his attention to the teacher. All right, thanks. So yeah, overall, this book is the story of a young woman named Eva Torvald. You meet her when she's born, each chapter is told from the point of view of a different person she comes across in her life, and centered around a different ingredient at the point that ingredient comes into her life. And all of the ingredients and some of the people come together in the final chapter at a dinner that's served. So that's the basic structure of it. But it's basically about a young woman who grows up to become a chef in the Midwest. Yeah. All right. Any more questions? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Amy Hero, please.
Amy asked how the author came up with the idea for Eva.
Oh, wow. That's a great question. I'm glad I get to answer it here. I know a couple of chefs. One who isn't here today, Amy Schabert Kovacs, and yeah, she's great. Great Minnesota chef. If you've been to Butter, you've had her work. She and my friend Patty Clark are the two chefs I know the best, and I guess when I thought of a chef, I thought of them, and I, you know, would ask them questions, and if I had recipes or menu items, I would run them by them. And when I discovered I was writing a food story and it was centered around a chef, I did kind of fall back on the two I know the best. And so does that answer your question? Yeah, okay. Yeah, I take after my dad a bit in these situations. So if I end up talking about like combines or motorcycles after a while, Yeah, just raise your hand and say, you're off topic, you know. It's all right, yeah. Yes, Pamela.
Pamela asked if the author wrote the story in order if each of the chapters was written as a separate piece.
Oh, that's a good question. No, I wrote it completely out of order. The first chapter I wrote that made the book was Venison, actually. And then Eva's chapter was the second one, because I wanted to get to know her as a person. The last chapter and the first chapter were the two closest to the end, and then the final chapter was Octavia's. So it was really all over the place. I had initially come up with the idea of writing about a dinner party, the kind of dinner party where, you know, I'm sure everyone here has been in a situation like this where you go and you're like, the only person I know here is the host. I don't know all these other people, but they all know the host as well, obviously. And when I'm in that kind of situation, I'm always curious about how did all these people get to meet the host? How did we all end up in the same room? And I thought I would tell a story of a dinner party working backwards from that conceit. But very quickly, I decided that the host and not the guest were really important. And I really wanted to center the narrative around the host. So I kind of inverted it. And very briefly, the dinner party was a framing device. But I scrapped the idea of starting at the dinner party and working out. And just now I just end there. So it seems kind of like a little convenient that a lot of people that you meet along the way end up at the end. But initially, it wasn't planned like that. Initially, it was like you start with these people and you figure out how they got there backwards. But now it's a little easier to read now because it's all consecutive. It's all, what's the word for sequential? Yeah, linear. Yes, exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah. I'm out of words. Yeah. Put them all in here. Yeah. Yes.
Somebody asked if the author wrote in an organized fashion or if all the words just came out in a tumble and he had to pick up the pieces later on.
Oh, Kate's laughing already. Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm about as organized as a Jell-O salad. No, I just throw the stuff out into a bowl and I write by kind of winnowing down. I just throw it down and then edit down. Yeah, so yeah, I overwrite and then cut back. I'm not super precious about my first drafts. I'm not one of those. I go back and examine each sentence for its ultimate beauty and masterfulness later. Yeah, I don't stress over like, oh, is this the best way I could say this? Sometimes I'll even make little notes to myself when I'm writing like cliche, like, you know, to make sure I change it later. But for the most part, I overwrite. Yeah. Yes, Kate.
Kate asked if it was difficult for him to write with so many POV characters.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it was a challenge. Yeah. But I try to spend a lot of time with each character so I could get into their head. Hey, Jeff, come on in. Take a seat. Hey, Phyllis. Hey, Jamie. Yeah, it was such a wide range of people that I didn't, when I was writing a chapter, I didn't skip between, you know, I just stuck with it. You know, I'd just stay in it until I was done with it. And then when I was editing, I also did it one piece at a time. But no, it was so much fun to write from all these different perspectives. It made it more interesting to me because I also felt like I wanted to capture a range of Midwesterners. I certainly couldn't capture them all, but I wanted to get a number of different types of people. If I was going to call the book Kitchens of the Great Midwest, which is what I saved the Word file as the first time I saved it, I thought, oh boy, that's kind of a mandate to cast a net. So I figured I'd better include different types. And one of the types I was most excited to include was like deer hunters, for example, who you might not always think of as part of the like the food or restaurant chain, but they have as intimate and as intense a relationship to food as anybody. And so it was really fun to write that chapter, as well as like a dinner party, like hostess, you know, like kind of the other end of things, people who really overthink and are really precious about specific ingredients. It was a lot of fun to write about them too. Oh, Chris, yeah.
Chris asked why Jay Ryan decided to set the story in the Midwest.
Wow, it's just what I wanted to write about, man. I've lived in L.A. for 17 years, and no part of me wants to write about Los Angeles. Yeah, and that's been done a lot too. And I don't want to write about TV either. Boring. Yeah, I know. It's just like I don't have anything to say about it. But I woke up in the morning every day I was writing this book, and I just really wanted to be with these people and in this setting. I was so excited to wake up every morning and just feel like this is who I want to spend time with. Yeah, and it was also a way that I was kind of keeping my mom alive in my heart. You know, she didn't live to write a book. So I felt like, in some ways, I was writing a book that she would have written. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, thanks. But, yeah. Any other questions so I don't get too teary up here? Stalling tactic?
How long did it take you to write the book?
Oh, wow. I wrote the first draft in about a year, actually. Yeah, just under a year. I started on February 25th of 2013 and finished on February 24th of 2014. Yeah, I kept a diary of it. I could probably show you. Yeah. It was really fun. Like every day I wrote a chapter, I wrote down what, or every day I worked on a chapter, I wrote down what chapter I worked on. And let's see, here it is. Yeah, here it is. And so, yeah, this is the novel. Yeah. Yeah, I think you're the first people I've ever shown this to. This is pretty great. Yeah, I'm glad it was you. So, yeah, about a year. But then, of course, editorial notes, copy edits, you know, all that kind of stuff, a lot of copy edits. I actually even hired a copy editor before the book went out to agents, even. I just wanted to make sure I didn't have all my usual misspellings and grammatical errors in it. So it didn't take that long, but there were some false starts a little bit. Three of the first four chapters I wrote didn't end up making the final cut. So I was writing into it, and like I said, you know, kind of scrapping this idea of working backwards from a dinner party and recalibrating the narrative. So, yeah, and also discovering my main character. Like, once I'd written that chapter where she's 11 years old and growing hydroponic hot peppers in her closet in Iowa, I thought, okay, now I know who this person is. She's great. I want to spend as much time with her as possible. Yeah, yeah, and I really set out to make her the focus and make her independently directed. I did not want to write a novel where her goal was at all oriented by a romance or by a dude. I wanted her to have a goal and just go for it and build a family along the way. It's about the family you're born into, but also the family of choice that you accrue in your life. And it was a lot of fun to write about someone for whom the family choice doesn't preclude the family you're born into. You know, like, you can add to your life without erasing what's come before it. And by her being a Midwest chef and staying in the Midwest and reconciling the Midwestern traditions of, like, bars and hot dishes with our current fascination with Epicurean and locavore cuisine, I think I did my best at that. Yeah.
What are you doing next?
Oh, I'm writing my next book. I'm 80 pages into it. I won't say anything about it other than it's also set in the Midwest. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, Tony.
Tony noted there's a lot of mentions of casserole in the book, and was wondering if in later editions it will be changed to the correct Minnesota pronunciation of hot dish.
I know. Yeah, instead of hot dish. I know. Yeah, that was... Yeah. Yeah. I believe so. That's a great note. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's where 17 years in California will do to you. Yeah, that was a tremendous oversight. And also, yeah, the New York editor and copy editor would not know that either. Yeah, yeah. Great, great note, Tony. You just might see that. Yeah. Yes, Allie.
Allie wondered if Jay Ryan saw a little bit of himself in each of his characters.
Oh, God, every single one of them. Yeah, every single one of them. That's some aspect of me is in every single one of them. No, there's a guy near the end that's specifically based on me. He's a really annoying customer at a wine bar. But there's pieces of me in all of these people. There's Jordy, Will Prager, Octavia. Yeah, no, like, I've put aspects of myself in all these people. I don't think I could write them otherwise. Yeah.
Are each of the characters based on people you've met in your real life?
Yeah, there's a lot of composite characters. There is one character directly based on a person. That's the annoying wine customer. A lot of the characters in this book are based on combinations of people that I've met through my life, particularly here in the Midwest. Yeah. In some cases, people might recognize things that they said or, yeah. 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 Names were changed. Yeah. 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 Anything else?
Somebody who knows J. Ryan mentioned that he used a lot of his own friends' names in the book, and they were just wondering what names he's going to use in the next book.
Oh, you'll just have to see. Yeah. 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 No, that was a lot of fun, especially whenever there was a minor character. I thought, oh, I could use one of the old names from my Earl Weaver baseball days, or I could actually use like names of people I know, you know, particularly with the characters that didn't have speaking lines. It's really just a no-brainer, you know, like names like, you know, Ken Kovacs or Ellen Chamberlain or like Pastor Evan, you know. It's like, yeah, if I have to have a pastor, it'll be a pastor I know, you know. Yeah, and I just hope that they're okay with it, you know. Yeah, you know, Brandon Spencer, you know, there are a lot of names in the book that are combinations. At one point, a whole row of women I knew in high school, like Allie, Kayla, Amber, and Amy and Sarah are mentioned in a row at one point. Yeah, so basically, whenever I had that opportunity, I thought, well, it also kept me in the mindset of the book. You know, when I was thinking about the people I grew up with, it just seemed part and parcel of the setting, you know. So in other words, it didn't feel like a conceit or a gimmick to me to name characters after people I knew. It felt like if I'm going to name them after anyone, you know, it's going to be people that, frankly, were tremendously influential and helpful and supportive of me, you know. It's the least I can do. Yeah, so it's, yeah.
Somebody asked what J. Ryan's teachers think of the book that he wrote.
Yeah, I don't know, boy. Yeah, I haven't heard from my Tilden teachers yet. Yeah. Yeah, I'd be curious. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Somebody was wondering what promoting the book was like.
Oh, well, so far promoting, it's been surreal. It's also been really really fun in the aspect that, well, first of all, there's been food pretty much everywhere I've gone. Yeah. Yeah, I'm so glad I didn't write a book about welding. I was that close. Yeah, welders of the Iron Range. That might be next. Yeah. 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 And I'd have to come to Travis for that. The character would be named probably Steel Travis or something. Yeah. I'd actually get a lot of really great fabricated, you know, motorcycle parts out of that tour probably. But with this one, yeah, I'm getting a lot of bars and desserts. So I'm pretty happy about that. But overall it's been pretty surreal. But also, like, other than like here in Los Angeles, nobody knows me, you know. It's I read in Cordy Madera and five people came and one person bought a book. So, you know, it's a great store and I'm sure they'll continue to support me, but there's a lot of stops like that along the way too where, you know, I'm just like, yeah, I'm just this random guy from Minnesota who's going to read from this book that you probably think is a cookbook. And, oh, wait, oh, you're leaving because you thought it was a cookbook. But it's great. You know, I'm happy to do it everywhere. Yeah, it's been so much fun. Yeah, I'm not going to lie. Like this has been the best year of my life, and other than the year I spent working on this book, and to connect with so many people from my life and have people that I've known through various aspects of my life, like so many, you know, like the people I grew up with here, people that have known me since, you know, before I was born. If that's possible. Yeah. Yeah. And definitely people, you know, like my cousins, Chris and Corinne, and my brother, Jeff, people of, you know, my aunt and uncle Donnie and Isla, you know, just, yeah, it's been, wow, it's been surreal. And I'm so glad that, this book is an occasion to reconnect with them. All right. Okay. If that's it. Yeah. Let's go for a drink. Yeah. Oh, first, yeah, I guess I'll sign books. Yeah, there's that. Yeah, I'm going to go do that over there by this counter. I'll see you over there.